For the week of March 8th, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 484, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, in self-imposed isolation, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Dixon City, Pennsylvania, I'm Michael Giltz.
Are you in self-imposed isolation? Quarantine?
If I was, it wouldn't be in Dixon City.
Oh, okay.
No, there's nothing wrong with Dixon City. It's just near my brother's. I'm outside of Panera to get the Wi-Fi and do our broadcast. I'm heading back into the city for the week. I'm doing my annual IRA event where I vote on the best movies of the year with guys who've been doing it for 40 plus years. Also finishing my best music of the year list. Isn't that far behind? But yes, it's coming out. So it's been a busy week. I've also been catching up on some stuff that we talked about last week to make some clarifications. Bob Iger, who is now the emeritus head of Disney, he's, you know, the CEO will still report to him, the Bob number two. But Bob Iger did indeed run ABC for a decade. However, one of the trades did reference him as being, you know, that being the slap against him, that just like Michael Eisner, people said, oh, he has no creative content experience. They said the same about Bob Iger. I took that and I believed it because it sounded like an insidery comment that no one would make unless it was true. And since then, I haven't really been able to find any backing up of that. I don't see a lot about him making big creative decisions at ABC, though the network was number one when he moved up higher into Disney. You know, it was ABC, then Cap Cities, then bought by Disney. And as far as I know, he was involved creatively, but I haven't been able to back that up one way or the other.
If you recall, I mentioned that last week.
That's why I looked into it further.
Yeah.
And also Disney Publishing, they are distributed by Hachette, which is the company that just bought like 1,000 plus titles from them, but they are not owned by Hachette in whole or in part. That's just simply a business arrangement. So Disney Publishing is wholly independent. They did make this decision to stop bothering with any book they didn't see as either part of a franchise or part of a potential franchise, which I think is a mistake, and I think you do too. But it is independent. It is not the same company just moving stuff from one division to another. And finally, the Iranian director, Mohammad Rusulov, is that how you say his name?
Rusulov.
Rusulov, thank you. He has been called in to serve his one-year prison term for previous public statements. He's refusing to turn himself in and is appealing. So we are keeping an eye on that and hoping the best for him.
By the way, you can send your comments to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can tell us how we both butchered that name.
That's right. Exactly. Did you include our email from a reader this week? I don't see it. You mentioned last week we were going to tease it.
It's funny because we also got an email about the difference between a chairman and a CEO and about how, you know, effectively the CEO is the, you know, fiscal head of the company. Mm-hmm. And the chairman is really kind of an emeritus title in many instances.
Right. People are the chairman and CEO. You know,
right, exactly.
So it all depends on that particular company and the flow chart. You can call yourself worker number one and be in charge.
I mean, technically everybody reports to the chairman, but you know, I've actually worked for several different companies that had chairman, and at least two of them, actually the chairman would come in like maybe once a week, maybe once or twice a month.
Hey, that's the life of Riley.
Yeah. Well, that said, I did forget to include the email, so that's my fault. We'll have to do it the following week.
Well, what are we going to talk about this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're obsessed with the coronavirus. You know, why would we be any different from the rest of the world? I mean, everybody's obsessed with it. It's affecting the box office, it's affecting tourism, the U.S. presidential race, and even our podcast. We'll cover more of the ripple effects of the pandemic, which, by the way, it's not really truly a pandemic yet, sort of. By the way, we're also going to include a certain secret British agent, okay, in our coverage, because he is shaken and stirred, at least stirred enough to change his release date. We'll also give an update on labor negotiations involving the WGA, the DGA, and the AMPTP. Hey, somebody get me an alphabet. I'm running out of letters. On Inside Baseball, we'll take a closer look at the music business. The music biz. That's right. Music streaming is starting to churn out some serious dough. People in Japan still prefer their compact discs, and apparently one person in the United States, that being me. Though, by the way, streaming is catching up, and a new competitor has popped up in India. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll discuss all the week's top headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office.
And just a reminder to people, that title is a joke. entertainment journalist extraordinaire. We're kidding. People,
well, you are. You are.
One time they said, oh, golly, really? I can't believe you. I go, well, we're kidding. We're not serious, for heaven's sake.
Well, you are. You know, look, you're on the road.
I'm in Dixon City, Pennsylvania.
You're going to entertainment events
all over America.
All over America. But that's where I was heading.
In a self-quarantined car. And looking at box office around the world, it is quiet. It is very quiet. As Sperling pointed out, wow, look at that comp score chart. There were only 12 movies listed on the official comp score chart. True, it's March. That's a relative slow time of the year. But 12 months a year are busy now, thanks to movies opening up in February and March and April. So there's no period that should be this slow. And you can't point the finger at any one particular film or market. China's dead completely. There's nothing happening in that market. Other countries are starting to slow down, like in Italy and so on. Will it keep spreading out to the rest of the world? We will have to see. But for the moment, the number one movie around the world is Pixar's Onward, an animated film starring the voice of Tom Holland. It made $68 million on its opening week, one of the lower opening grosses of all time, really, for a Pixar film in the recent 10 or 15 years. And as prognosticators, Disney as a studio, everyone can thank coronavirus, because it's going to give you a pass for the next year. No matter what your film
is,
no matter what happens to it, no matter how it's handled, no matter the quality of the film, you can always point to the coronavirus and say, well, who knows? Maybe it would have opened bigger.
That's right.
Maybe it would have opened smaller. This movie looks like it's not doing great. It's a little more anonymous. The audiences like it a lot, but they don't love it completely as they often do with Pixar films. It's harder to open up a new release, of course. It didn't have quite the hook that Soul, a movie coming out in the summer that we all expected to do better, had. We'll have to see where it ends up, but it's blocked from the second biggest market in the world, and box office in other European countries is going to be slow. It opened okay, $40 million in North America. Maybe it will have legs. Maybe families will keep going to the movies, or maybe they'll stay away because they're scared. No matter what happens, whether movies overperform or underperform, you can blame the virus and not your marketing, not the movie, and not me, right? I just did a story for you, didn't I?
Yes, that's right. You did a story on basically, and by the way, talk about late. Well, we were a little late on that one. In fact, I think we had to rewrite a couple of...
That's right. We were looking at making an argument that the year's box office is not bare, that there are a lot of big, important films. People who looked at 2019 and then 2020 said, oh my God, nothing's coming out.
We said, that's right. Yeah.
There are a lot of big movies coming out. There are every year. This is not going to be a wash. And I went through all the big movies and said, these look like good singles or doubles. This looks like it could be a big hit. This should make more than 300. This should make more than 600. This should make more than $900 million. Well, I can thank you, because no matter what I predicted, no matter how wrong I am, and I may be wrong right away with Onward, and in fact, The Way Back, the Ben Affleck film, that's farther down on our list, I can just say, well, coronavirus. It wasn't me. It was coronavirus.
Right. Well, and the title of that, the headline, so to speak, is Second Guessing the 2020 Box Office Doomsayers. That is the headline. And you mentioned a 52-week year, right?
Absolutely.
And Jim Amos over at Celluloid Junkie, both of these pieces are on Celluloid Junkie that I'm talking about now. He did a story called The Return of the 52-Week Movie Business. And he did that in the midst of coronavirus. Yes, it is disrupting the movie business. It's disrupting all business. As we speak, the stock market is literally in free fall.
I thought they paused it.
They did for 15 minutes.
Ah, okay.
Once it hit 1,800 down.
And of course, the stock market was also long overdue for a correction, if not a recession.
Correct.
So again, you can blame the coronavirus. But
right,
there are
exactly.
lots of factors involved there. So looking back at the chart, the number one movie around the world is Onward, the Pixar film. It got good, if not great, reviews. It opened to...
Did you know that this was... I'm sorry, I just totally interrupted you. You were probably going to go to exactly what I was going to say. So what were you about to say?
I was going to say it made $68 million, and then I was going to move on to number two.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to tell us where it opened, which is like in all these places except for Italy, South Korea, and China. China, for obvious reasons, coronavirus. South Korea, for obvious reasons.
Well, I don't know if it was scheduled yet in China, of course, but...
Good point.
Yeah.
Italy, also coronavirus. A lot of France, well, not a lot, but portions of France has cinemas that are closed or kind of self-imposed closed, where they are closing themselves, or at least doing, half runs.
Okay.
So Yeah,
but it's a problem. But to look at North America, where the movie opened up in its biggest market, the number one market in the world, Saturday grew over Friday, which doesn't indicate people starting to stay away from the theaters. Its pattern looked typical for a movie that was getting good, not great, word of mouth, and good, not great attendance, and kids showing up. It's trending a little younger than other Pixar films. It seems to be appealing to a slightly younger set. It's not appealing as much to older teens and adults. So all those factors make us say that the North American box office so far has not been affected. But guess what?
It's up 4%. Well, week over week.
Well, week over week is always misleading. It depends on what was opening the week before and one year earlier. But looking at the rest of the world, which is where Hollywood makes at least grosses most of its money, doesn't necessarily take it home, but that's where it grosses most of its money, that is being affected. So Onwards at number one with $68 million. At number two is The Invisible Man. The Elizabeth Moss horror flick is doing great. Another $49 million this week. It's at $100 million worldwide. At number three is Sonic the Hedgehog. Another $30 million. That's about to pass $300 million. Then right below that is Harrison Ford's The Call of the Wild. Another $20 million. It's at $100 million. It has a long way to go before it triples its budget. It could be hard in this environment. But at number five is a big, big hit, no matter how you slice it. It's Parasite. $13 million it made this week. It's at $270 million worldwide. Now, I don't know anymore, but you know, you would have thought, hey, it looks like it's going to hit $300 million. At this stage, it may fall off the charts hard because of what's happening at box office. It may be mostly played out, but $270 million, that's a huge hit for this Korean film, one of the highest grossing foreign language films of all time in North America. And number six is the Will Smith film Bad Boys for Life, $415 million worldwide. And The Gentleman from Guy Ritchie, that has passed the $100 million mark. That's at $110 million and counting.
Which makes it actually kind of makes it a hit, because I think that budget was like only $30 million. So maybe not a hit.
No, it's
but
absolutely
certainly not a bomb.
No, it tripled its budget at the box office alone. That's definitely a hit, right? I mean, you always got to keep in mind, we're just assuming traditional spending on prints and advertising and marketing. It doesn't mean the movie is immediately profitable for the studio, but it does mean they've got a clear hit on their hands. And once all the other streaming elements come in, you know, all the down the road areas where you make money, all the ancillary markets, that's clearly going to be a profitable film. That's our rule of thumb, and it's perfectly reasonable to talk about for this movie. And number eight is a new film. It's The Way Back, starring Ben Affleck as an alcoholic who coaches a high school basketball team to glory. I don't know if it's glory, but I know he coaches them. It opened to $9 million. This was one of the movies I said in your list, hey, these are some of the quiet movies that can make $30, $40 million. And no, that will not matter or register in terms of the worldwide box office, but it keeps the lights on, gets adults going to the movies, keeps people in the movie going habit. It had that Hoosiers gritty vibe to it. It could be a real, you know, appealing across the board movie. And certainly Ben Affleck got good reviews. So the movie, not so much. And you really need good reviews for a movie like this to click. You know, it doesn't look like it'll be Rudy or Hoosiers, but it opened to $9 million. We'll have to see where it ends up. And number nine is Emma. The Jane Austen novel turned into yet another film adaptation that made $8 million this week, and that's at $20 million and counting. And number 10 is a film we pulled from the Bollywood charts. Comscore did not have this, but Baghi 3 is a Bollywood film starring Tiger Shroff, which one critic online said, the movie nobody was asking for. And it's also called a spiritual sequel to Baghi 1 and Baghi 2. So I guess it has nothing technically to do with those earlier films, but it stars the same action star, and it made $7 million worldwide on its opening week. That's the same amount that Harley Quinn's movie, Birds of Prey, made. That's about to pass the $200 million mark. And then there's Blumhouse's Fantasy Island that made $5 million. That's at $45 million, a great win for them. And looking down, there are one new movie. First, Impractical Jokers, the movie. That made another $3 million. I don't know the budget, but I am certain it was dirt cheap. I doubt it cost more than $1 million. It's at $9 million and counting. I'm sure this one won't travel overseas, but they've made a lot of money in North America. And then finally, there's The Kangaroo Chronicles, which sounds like an Australian film, but it's not. It's a German comedy by a stand-up comic who has this ongoing gag about being roommates with a practical communist kangaroo. A kangaroo who, for practical reasons, is a communist. And they have all these arguments about politics, and apparently they've turned it into a film that made $3 million on its opening week. And then in limited release, Kelly Reichardt's film First Cow had the best opening of her career, great reviews, and 24,000 per screen average on just four screens. It's a period film set in the frontiers of North America. My apologies to the Indigenous Americans for calling it a frontier, but it's two guys who start a business by surreptitiously milking the cow of a rich man and using that to build a business. So I can't wait to see it. I'm going to be in New York, and that's certainly one of the movies I have on my list to see.
You know, I actually saw a movie over the weekend that I can recommend, which is the movie Swallow. Have you heard of this film?
No, I don't think I have.
It's and I'm trying to remember. I think it was by Carlo Mirabella Davis, and it was written and directed by Carlo Mirabella Davis. It's about a wife named Hunter. And she is played by Haley Bennett, who's actually one of the producers as well. She's actually quite good in this role. And she has a syndrome called pica, which means she swallows things that are non-nutritional, like, I don't know, thumbtacks.
Oh, ouch.
Yeah, and it's about her, you know, abusive relationship. It's actually quite good. I have a feeling, you know, everybody should try and see this film if they can. It's in a limited release. But I have a feeling that it's going to be one of those films that the director goes on to do like bigger things, and everybody goes back and says, "Memento, what was that? Hey, we should go see that." That Christopher Nolan guy, you know, he was doing films long before Batman.
Well, that's a strong recommendation.
Yes, it's a strong recommendation.
Well, if they can't see it in theaters, it'll probably be available on streaming as I do my best of the year list. It's nice to see how many movies you can access now. Sure, you got to have Hulu or via your library, maybe Canopy or Disney Plus or Netflix, but there are a lot of movies, really small, obscure movies that are available online now, which is great. It just means more people can see these movies than ever before. They're certainly not going to the theaters, right? Because that's going to be a big problem. That brings us to the coronavirus update.
Although I'd like to point out, you mentioned that, hey, look, you know, and I agree with you, by the way, that week-to-week box office is kind of silly, normally, because, you know, well, what if something came out last week that was like Avengers? Well, of course it's going to be down this week. Well, the reason I pointed it out that it's 4% over last weekend is because people aren't stopping, at least in North America.
Right.
They're not stopping going to the movies. That's a horrible way to say that, I realize. However, one thing I did want to point out, that last week, the box office was up between 3% and 4% just last week, year on year. Okay. So everybody was saying, oh, 2020 is going to be horrible. Oh, it's not going to make any money. And Michael, as you pointed out in your piece, actually, you know, it's up 4%. But just the difference one weekend makes, because last weekend, Captain Marvel opened up last year on this weekend, it went from 3% to 4%. Over to 1.9% below 2019.
Right. Well, that's what can happen when it's early in the year. There aren't a lot of movies yet. You have one big blockbuster film, and that can throw off your stats, which is why you want to put it in context, as you've done just now. And we certainly don't, even before the coronavirus, there was every reason to think this year might be below last year. Maybe it would be the third highest grossing year of all time. But that doesn't mean disaster. Of course, if you're an exhibitor, you want every year to be bigger than the year before. You want more butts in the seats, but that's just not realistic. And so to have a sane long-term perspective, you have to say, okay, 2019 was lower than 2018, but it was the second highest grossing year of all time in North America. So maybe disaster hasn't struck.
No, but I can almost guarantee you, and I'm just putting on my Karnak hat. And if you don't know who Karnak is, Google Johnny Carson Karnak, and you'll be set.
We understand how Google works. Yes. Keep going.
I know that this April will be lower than last year's April.
Because?
Because Bond, James Bond, will be moving No Time to Die from April to November of this year because of the coronavirus. Although I have heard that they should change the name to More Time to Die, or just delete the No and just have it be Time to Die and release it in April.
Oh my God. Okay. So the James Bond film has moved to the fall. Tentatively, we'll have to see if it stays there, but I assume they'll stick to it if, movie going gets back to normal. However, I was just in a 7-Eleven going down the highway. I pulled in and there was a lottery ticket scratch off, which was a James Bond scratch off, obviously a tie-in to No Time to Die. Those are the sort of things that take a hit. When we talked about Mulan delaying its release, that's not happening because there are so many moving parts for that film. The toys and games and merchandise are already in the stores. They're already in the fast food restaurants. They're already poised to be sold. And you can't unwind that or have them just shove it in a warehouse for 6 months or 8 months. It's not that easy to do. James Bond has lots of advertising tie-ins, but it's not...
Hey, Daniel Craig was on Saturday Night Live this week to promote the film, and he kind of had to make light of the fact that, well, I'm a little early.
Yes, and there are prices to be paid, but even for that film, which does not have all the merchandising like Mulan, that film's move from April to the fall is going to cost the studio $30 to $50 million. So that's it, you know. But of course, if you're talking about losing out on hundreds of millions of dollars in the worldwide market, that's a decision you're going to make. But it is an expensive one. It's also expensive.
Yeah, I guess it boils down to, gee, we're going to lose China. Can we make $100 million in China? If yes,
well, and Europe,
then move the film.
And Europe.
And in Europe.
Yeah, yeah. They're
yes.
saying, look, in 4 weeks, we got to make the decision now. We can't wait to find out if England and France and Germany and Spain are going to be open. We have to decide now. And that's
Could you tell that to, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Every single event I have to go to between this day that I am speaking these words, Monday, May 9th, March 9th, and say, I don't know, June 15th, because literally there are so many things that I have to attend that are up in the air. I guess I can throw out South by Southwest, which we'll talk about in a second, but there's CinemaCon, which is still going on. There is Cannes, which says, despite what's going on there, that they are still going ahead. MIP TV, that was canceled. That's in Cannes.
Right.
But it's also in March. Mm-hmm. So
right. So Cannes will decide later if it has to shut. And we'll probably wait for the government to decide for very good financial reasons. And that may in part have been the case for South by Southwest. The mayor of Austin declared a local disaster due to the coronavirus. And now finally, the people behind the convention or whatever you call it have pulled the plug. And they also revealed at the same time that their insurance does not cover disease cancellation. If there's a hurricane, I guess you're covered. But if there's a pandemic, you're not covered. Most insurance policies don't cover that.
No, they don't. Actually, all insurance policies do not cover that. You have to buy a special rider and
well,
a special
waiver. Well, then it does. what do you mean it doesn't? It doesn't unless you pay for it. Of course you can pay for it.
Right,
you can,
but if you buy the out-of-the-box...
There's no such thing as out-of-the-box. Well, you got to depend on what city and what state you're in. You got to make sure your hurricane coverage also includes rain coverage and flooding coverage, because they'll say, well, that wasn't the wind, it was the rain. You know, they'll pay to replace your roof, but not all the water damage that came in after your roof was ripped off. You're like, really?
Well, it used to be that it did cover communicable diseases, which is the communicable disease rider.
There are millions of difference of insurance policies. It depends what
company. Event coverage. Event coverage. Now, it used to, but then SARS came along and they went, we better not put that in the regular.
Right.
You know,
you want that, you're going to pay more.
Right. Now, there has been some pushback on what do you mean your insurance policy didn't cover it? Because if it didn't and you didn't buy the rider and the waiver, then that's on you, my friend, and you actually deserve to go out of business for that. And the thinking is, well, they don't, the people that show up to South by Southwest, the big artists that show up, they get minimum guarantees. So whether it goes on or not, they will get their minimum guarantee.
Right.
And so all of the minor artists, of course, do not get that. And so the thinking is that they're saying that so that the artists don't
come
back.
Well, they're saying it perhaps because it's true. You're not saying they're lying. Are you saying they're lying?
I'm saying that they might be kind of pushing what the coverage actually is.
You're saying they might be people behind South by Southwest are lying when they're saying our insurance will not cover this cancellation and now we're facing a huge financial hole. You're saying they are lying.
Well, they are facing a huge financial hole. That is undisputed.
No,
that is
they're
true.
Saying our insurance doesn't cover this and we are facing a huge financial hole because in part our insurance will not cover this cancellation. So we're in the pocket, out of pocket for everything. You're saying they are lying to people? On what are you basing that? You're just saying other people said, well, you're idiots if you didn't have it.
Based on some of the music managers I've talked to that said,
you're saying they're lying. The music managers are saying the people behind South by Southwest are lying to the media and the public about their insurance coverage. And they are making it sound worse than it actually is. Because they're hoping artists will say, never mind, I don't need my cancellation.
Correct. That is exactly right.
Well, that's a huge accusation to make without any evidence other than a music manager claiming, yeah, that can't be true. I mean, I really wouldn't say that unless you actually had something firmer behind that. I think it's fair to say if you didn't have that coverage, you're idiots because we had the recent years of SARS and Ebola that should have taught you that's a rider you need to have. But, you know, people get caught all the time with their insurance. They assume it's covered and then they find out when they look closer, it's not, you know, like hurricane coverage. They'll repair your roof, but they literally won't repair the water damage done to your home, which is extensive, after your roof has blown off. And you would, you know, people think, well, you know, I got hurricane coverage. Well, no, it doesn't.
It's like, here's your roof. You need a house to put it on.
Yeah. So I would like to have something firmer than a rumor from a music manager that, well, they're idiots if they didn't have it to back that up. I think that's a fair criticism, I guess. But I'd like to have more than, you know, well, some guy said he figures they're lying before you go public saying that. So,
well, you know, the Ultra Music Festival actually kind of, they do have that coverage, and they were very upfront by saying we cannot cancel until the Miami authorities
pull the plug. Yeah.
And pull the plug. Once they do that, then we can say, all right,
right,
you know what? It's not on us. We would have continued to hold this insurance company, but we were forced to close down by the authorities.
Of course, you can't just decide, you can't just announce yourself there's a hurricane coming and you're canceling your event because it may be because you didn't sell tickets. So you have to have an official announcement. It's not like they're playing games. They're just following the proper procedure. Anyway, there are endless cancellations all over the world for lots of sporting events. I'm a big tennis fan, and the Indian Wells tennis tournament has just canceled it. You know, there's lots of TV rights, and of course, they want, it's a big, big tournament, and they want people to show up and pay all that money. That's how they generate a lot of fees. But TV's number one, so you have to ask, why not just hold the event without fans? Why not just have the players play?
Funny you should mention that, because you know where Indian Wells is? It's in Rancho Mirage, and do you know where Rancho Mirage is? It's about 10 miles away from Indio. And do you know what happens in Indio in April? The Coachella Music Festival. And you know who shows up to the Coachella Music Festival? About 120,000 people a day.
Well, and that will almost certainly be canceled.
And that's the big question. I did see a poster, like a mock poster, that had the, you know, the Coachella lineup with the big, all the bands listed. And as the headliner on Friday night, it was coronavirus.
Hilarious. Hasn't the governor of California declared a state of emergency for some parts of the state or all of it? Or
yeah, for the state itself, there are reasons for that.
Well, yeah, you get government money and support.
Right, exactly.
Of course. Well, the reasons are it's a state of emergency. Again, you make it sound like they're playing a game. Well, they just said to get funding. Well, no, that's, you declare a state of emergency because it's
what you
for.
Do. It's in the rule book. Yeah. It's in the rule book.
That's right.
You know, actually, this thing is moving so fast and the news is moving so fast that literally as we're talking, things are changing.
Well, it's
the point where on Friday night they were saying, you know, Coachella, look, Riverside, why cancel it? There's been no cases found in Riverside, which, don't get me started on that.
Well, that's,
it doesn't matter.
Stupid logic, right?
Yeah,
people coming from all over the country. Yeah,
right. So putting that aside, okay, putting that logic aside for just a second, they said that on Friday night. Yeah, on Saturday afternoon, they were like, hey, first case found in Indio. Well, okay, guess what? That's that's ground zero for Coachella. So
right, but that doesn't answer my question. Why not play the tennis tournament without fans? You have the TV coverage. That's where a lot of your money is happening. You have players looking to get points and move forward in the season. It would be safe to have players and umpires and ball kids there, I think, or maybe not ball kids. I don't know. They can get their own damn balls. But they could maintain the TV coverage, maintain the event. It's obviously very different without having fans there, but they could play.
Yeah, well, and actually, a couple things. One, they're also thinking about all of the support staff and teams that need to come in for the broadcast itself, just the broadcast teams.
Right, but it's not nearly, it's, you know, when they talk about don't be in crowds, they're talking about thousands and thousands of people. That's not what we're talking about when we're talking about
hundreds. Yeah, you're talking about maybe 1,000 people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just like Khan is not, you know, the big theater holds like 2,300 people. That's not what they're talking about when they're talking about avoiding, you know, giant groups of, you know, 10, 15, 20,000 people.
No, they're talking about, and the funny thing is, in Cannes, every year, like clockwork, you've been there, Michael, you know what it's like trying to get into even the Debussy, right? The scrum where everybody's rubbing up against one another, trying to squeeze in between those gates.
Right.
I wonder if they're going to, if Cannes happens, I wonder if they're going to say, even if, I'm just, you know, let me finish the thought, because yes, I don't think CinemaCon's going to happen, but I hope it does, but it's questionable. I just wonder if they kind of open the gates a little bit wider this year so that people aren't rubbing up against one another, number one. And number two, it's always, ironically, the big joke with Americans, it's always the Italians that are pushing through, like you know, they're
always
so
like, well, they'll get a wide berth this year. They'll let them in first.
Exactly. We were joking around like, well, this year they'd be like, after you. It's right. Kind of very funny.
Right. The same question will face the Olympics. Should they hold the Olympics without fans? Should they? Obviously, again, that's very different. Takes away the home field advantage. It's weird to compete in an empty stadium, but they do it. They practice or they compete, and they have games and scrums. So, you know,
I'm more likely to say that they should, because those athletes train for years. You know what? Fine. You know what? You don't want the crowds there. That is disappointing enough, by the way.
Yeah.
To not have the crowds there, whether it's the home field advantage or just for the pomp and circumstance.
Yeah, have
of
your
it
family
all.
There. Yeah.
Yeah, but at the very least, Let the athletes.
If it can be done safely, you'd let the medical and science people decide. The medical and science people decided part of Italy should be quarantined. 16 million people were going to be placed under quarantine. Unfortunately, the government announced it without immediately putting it in place. And now people are trying to flee the area because they don't want to be trapped in that part of Italy. But it's affecting everything. The Broadway theater, you know, theaters all over the world, I'm sure. But the Broadway theater industry, they are doing intensive cleaning between shows, just like some movie theaters are doing. And when is North America going to start doing that? And how much will it cost them to do that? Some shows like Hadestown are ending the meet and greet. After every show, you can line up by the stage door and get your photos taken with the cast and get them to sign your playbill. It's adorable. It's fun. People wait 40 minutes for their favorite stars to come out. It's chatty. It's friendly. It's fan servicing. It's great. It's also a great way to catch a cold or a flu, or in this case, coronavirus. And I bet in 2 minutes, every single Broadway house is going to stop doing it. They're going to say, nope, you can't wait. They're not going to stop. They can't. We're not doing it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, that just makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Yeah. France has banned gatherings of more than 5,000 people. So
actually, that was changed to 1,000 just last night.
Well, then that means Con will be canceled because.
But the ban goes until like April 3rd or something.
Right, but it could be extended and they can't wait to find out. At some point, they're going to have to decide before, you know, they announced the lineup in April. They're going to have to decide if the ban is going to get extended.
In fact, they kind of, in a very kind of, they said, look, it's business as usual. In fact, we're announcing the lineup April 16th.
Yeah.
Darn it.
Well, I one lesson to be learned is make sure all your plane tickets have that $25 rescheduling fee or refund fee, you know, for if you have to cancel an event. You know, make sure every flight you book, you pay that extra money so you can get all your money back minus that $25 or $50.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's not business as usual for the WGA and the DGA. What's going on there?
Well, okay, the WGA, we've been talking about the WGA for a while now and its battle against the ATA, okay, which is the Association of Talent Agencies, and how they don't want packaging to be done by the agents and many, many other things that all relate to that, including affiliated production companies that are affiliated with the agencies, so that they're both representing the talent and buying the talent. But they then kind of put out their demands for the upcoming writer's contract negotiations with the AMPTP.
Which is?
Okay. The Association of Motion Picture and Television Producers.
Meaning the people who make movies and TV shows.
Correct.
Big studios, so the studios, indie producers, yeah. People like that.
Yeah. And when they put this out, now this is, just follow me here because this might get a little
It's not
tricky.
Complicated. We talked about it 2 weeks ago. They were going to ask the studios to say, don't do business with the talent agencies who haven't signed with us.
Which is called the Collins Clause.
And now, today, or recently, they have announced we are dropping that as part of our negotiations. There's too much stuff that we're dealing with, like residuals, where we have to make major improvements. Talks are stalled.
Streaming. We have to talk about streaming.
Well, that's what I talked about, residuals and for streaming and stuff. And talks aren't going anywhere. We don't believe we're going to get this at this stage anyway, so we are dropping that requirement, which is what happened.
But
it
wasn't like the WGA. Yeah, but the WGA didn't do that willingly.
Of course not.
Basically, the big showrunners came in and said, look, yes, we are a part, we're writers, and we are a part of your agency, of your guild. However, we're also producers, and we have to buy talent from agents. And yes, by the way, what I found out last week from more than a few people is that effectively, yes, there was a point where all the writers officially fired their agents, okay, and they were all fired. But then business had to go on, and contracts had to be negotiated. And everybody that I spoke with in business affairs said, yeah, we're dealing with the agencies. The agencies are still representing their.
So you're saying
talent.
Everybody is crossing the line and breaking
slowly.
The agreement that the WGA
slowly.
Made. Well, that's a majority of people. Everybody's back to business as usual. And they're all pretending that writers have fired their agents and aren't doing business with them anymore. The WGA recently announced we have helped writers sign more than 100 deals, which I thought sounded small. But you said, hey, it depends how big the deals are. You know, it may be significant. So. You're now saying, and have we seen this reported in the trades, that the vast majority of writers are breaking the lines, going against their own guild?
No, you're hearing it here because I actually did the legwork and called all the business affairs.
So this has not happened. This has not been reported in Variety and Hollywood Reporter. This is you saying, I've spoken to people. This is widely understood. They may not be talking
about
it.
Actually, what has been reported is the fact that, and in certain instances, you have to read between the lines. In certain instances, it's been called out point blank, which is the WGA has asked other writers to say to them, hey, if you know of a writer working with their
agent.
Right,
of course. Yes.
And one writer was quoted as saying, have you heard of the blacklist? Writers were kind of like,
that's not the blacklist. That's not right. No, but crossing a picket line is not the same as starting a blacklist. A blacklist is discriminated against people wrongly because of their personal beliefs. A union saying, hey, we've made this stand. Let's all stand together. And if you find out anybody isn't standing together, let us know, because we got to be stronger together. If you know a bunch of people are breaking the rules and that they're not holding firm in our union, we need to know. That's not akin to the blacklist. That's a union trying to do its job and saying, don't cross the picket line and don't work with your agents because we've all fired them officially. You're not supposed to be paying them, and this won't work unless we all stand
together.
Oh, they're
not paying them. They are not paying them.
That's one minor point, Sperling. If you're working with them and they're expecting to get recompense down the road, they're not doing the work for fun. They're not doing it as a gift. They expect, once everything gets back to usual, they're going to get all the money they were supposed to get, and they're going to get all the pieces of every contract that they helped happen. And you're saying,
yeah, well, and that's actually one of the business affairs people said to me. They said, you know, the agents at these agencies, and let's kind of call them out: Creative Artists Agency, UTA, United Talent Agency, William Morris Endeavor, ICM. There's a few others that have not signed the code of conduct with the WGA. They said all the agents are kind of pressuring their leadership to sit down already, because as they said, you know, look, they're doing all the work. They want to get paid for it.
Right. So that's a lot going on this week. And one other thing is that, of course, the WGA recently said it has had, quote, substantive discussions, end quote, with four of the five major agencies. But all the top four, the big four, have all said we are not. They are officially saying that's not true. We are not having discussions with them. So one of them is lying.
There has been some pushback on that because each one of the agencies has said it's not us, and everybody realizes that, you know, the one agency it would not be, absolutely not be, is William Morris Endeavor, because they have everything to lose by not doing by giving up packaging. Although something else I learned this week, which I kind of already knew, was that packaging is not really what it used to be, because syndication, as we all know,
you make a deal for you make a deal for Netflix. There is no package. There's no back end.
Right. So the packaging was already doing what it used to be.
You know, there's still a lot of money to be made. You make a show for CBS. You make the blacklist on NBC, which has just been re-upped for another season 7 or 8. You got a show on CBS. You got NCIS. You got Law and Order. You've got Chicago Med. That's going to have a big back end. So it's not like back ends don't exist. It's just, you know, obviously a lot of heat and energy is happening in the streaming world. So it's not as important.
Well, and everybody that I talked to said, look, they thought the WGA thing was not going to be settled anytime soon, and that there would be a huge strike until they took the Collins Clause out, this clause of having no producer work with, no studio work with an agency that wasn't a franchised agent if they didn't sign this code of conduct, etc. And basically the showrunner and the producer said, look, you're having us fight the battle, your battle. You want us to fight your battle. And that's, we can't do that, as you pointed out, Michael. And so they took it out, and that kind of undercut the WGA. The WGA,
and they changed their negotiation. They realized they weren't going to win that fight, so they removed it. That's how negotiations work.
Right.
You talk to your members, you talk to other people, you make a stand, and then if it doesn't work, you have to compromise or get rid of that demand.
Right. And the thinking now is that, well, the WGA had always assumed that this, you know, contract negotiation would help push this Collins Clause a little bit. Now that it's not going to, the thinking is, well, they're going to try and come to an agreement on this.
Well, of course they want to sign with AMPTP. We want that. The question is whether they come to an agreement with talent agencies.
But I'm talking about, that now that those agency agreements might get pushed along a little bit faster.
Well, so to clarify, they have dropped that demand in their discussions with the people who make movies and TV shows. They recognize that packaging doesn't matter as much anymore. That's not news to them. And you're saying a lot of writers and agents are crossing the line and not sticking with their guild and are not holding fast, that they are, by and large, doing business as usual basically. The agents are doing it under the table. They're not, you know, they're just help. You're calling agents. They're making business. They're just not doing it officially. And they are breaking the picket line, so to speak, that the Writers Guild has set in the sand here. And that's a big, that means a huge weakening of them. I'd love to see that reported in the trades. Or if you have information about people doing that, direct information, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, as I mentioned, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can, send us an email, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle, or reach out to us on Facebook. Facebook.com/showbizsandbox is where our page can be found.
That's right. And of course, the Writers Guild are negotiating with the producers behind movies and TV shows, and they're probably going to follow suit with the DGA. The Directors Guild has reached a deal. Their board has signed off on it. It's now going to go for a vote. We're waiting for official details, but a big gain in streaming looks like it's happened. Variety says that there has been a 50% increase in residuals for streaming video on demand. That's exactly the sort of increase they need, because that's where all the money is and there's no back end. So, you know, that's where all the dollars are. That's where you need to get your money.
Yeah. You know, the question then becomes, and this is also something the business affairs people mentioned, was, wait a second, how do you measure what should a residual be?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because, and by the way, you would think that these business affairs execs, and these are the people at studios, at production companies, that negotiate contracts with the producers for talent, and with the talent, with the like, they're basically behind everything. They're behind all the contracts.
Right. This is all they have to think about.
Right. And they're like, we don't know. Like, we go to Netflix and say, listen, can you just give us a little bit of data so that we can actually go back and fight for you to go and maybe not get such a big raise for those 13 Reasons Why people? They want a raise because they heard that the people on Stranger Things got a raise, and we don't know what the numbers are. So can you tell us what the numbers are so we can go back and say, you don't deserve a raise because you're not as popular as... Well, they can't get the numbers to fight their own fight for Netflix. It's just from...
They are a black hole of information. In fact, the DGA has signed a 3-year deal with Netflix. That happened a little while ago. We still don't know those terms. That's amazing that has not come out yet. So there's a lot of work to do for the trades. We want you to speak to the writers and find out about this crossing of the picket line, so to speak. And we want to know what was the deal with DGA and Netflix? What deal did they get? I think it'll be a big deal when we find all that out, because that will tell us whether we're going to be able to avoid a strike, which looks less likely now in terms of the AMPTP. But this ongoing struggle with the talent agencies, that seems murkier than ever to me.
That's true. And due to pattern bargaining, if the DGA settled first, or I don't want to say settled, negotiated first and has come to a deal, then the Writers Guild will kind of follow suit.
Right.
But you did mention the words deal and big, not in that order. So it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about MSNBC host Chris Matthews, because he is calling it a day. Not so shocking, since he's been hosting Hardball for 20 years, or as I'd like to say, only 10 years longer than we've been hosting Showbiz Sandbox. Okay. And yet, we're in the midst of a presidential election, so you know this firing / choice / whatever, it didn't come easily. Apparently, it's been an open secret that Matthews, he's kind of like relentlessly unpleasant to begin with, but certainly relentlessly unpleasant to his female guests and fellow journalists, making wildly inappropriate comments about their appearances, hitting on guests, according to at least one journalist who went public recently.
More than one.
Just as bad, by the way. Matthews treats the possible presidential nomination of Bernie Sanders as if it's like the Democrats were choosing Stalin. Matthews compared Sanders winning a primary to Hitler's invasion of France. Probably not a good, analogy there. And especially hateful comments, since Bernie's relatives were killed in the Holocaust. So it may have been a choice between an ugly internal investigation or retiring, or just a lot of people saying, you know what, it's time for you to go. Whatever the behind-the-scenes debate, Matthews is retiring. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's one more sign that, you know, people who've done this stuff for years and can't understand we live in a new world and the way they've behaved isn't acceptable anymore. They're astonished. They're confused that Harvey Weinstein is sitting in jail going, what? I thought all those women wanted to have sex with me when I threw them to the ground and, you know, attacked them. You know, Chris Matthews has made on-air comments about fellow journalists for decades. You know, oh, you look really hot. Oh, really great seeing you. Get closer to the camera. It's, I don't mind bad news when you're delivering it. Let's get that camera in closer. Stuff that you watch and you can see clips of it on YouTube and go, why is this guy still working there? But
a lot of people said that for years. Yes, like, what is going
on? So there's no doubt he has done stuff on the air. So we don't have to debate what he said in the green room or how he treated women or what one woman said and what other journalists say. We have enough evidence on air to say this guy did not belong on the air. If he couldn't change his pattern. And then seeing how he's unhinged. I don't care what you think of Bernie Sanders. Comparing him to Hitler is just an obscenity. That is, you have lost credibility. Even as a person who's just spouting off opinions week to week, that is pretty unhinged. And he had like 10 comments over the last few weeks when Bernie was on a roll that just were absurd. You know, that would get you a job at Fox News, but it won't get you a job anywhere else.
It kept getting worse and worse and worse. And like, look, I mean, a lot of people have faulted him for being, and I'm using this term, but I'm actually quoting it from numerous reports, gas bag was the adjective used.
Well, that's the job when you host an hour-long commentary show.
Exactly.
But that's got nothing to do with his behavior.
Some journalists said, look, you know, in regards to his asking tough questions of other journalists, it was a show called Hardball, but at the same time,
we're all for tough questions. It's got nothing to do with, you look hot, stand closer to the camera. It's not a tough question. It's just obnoxious. Yeah. Speaking of obnoxious, Woody Allen.
Oh, man. Well, the publishing world remains very small and very insular and very well-to-do and very white, but not very male, in fact. So that's a plus. Plus, a new generation is finding its voice. That may explain this next story, by the way. Imprints at major publishing houses often have a great deal of independence. So one division of Hachette published the Ronan Farrow story of how he helped break some of the big stories of the Me Too era. So that was called, what was it? Catch and Kill, I believe, was the name of that book, right?
I don't remember. Keep going.
And then, you know, another division of Hachette announced it was publishing the memoir of director Woody Allen, you know, a once highly sought after book that had gone begging since Allen was, you know, was tarred by longstanding claims he molested one of Mia Farrow's children. You know, by the way, it doesn't help that Allen very publicly dumped Farrow and subsequently married one of her adopted children. Yeah. Okay, that probably didn't help matters. Ronan Farrow saw the whole affair as duplicitous and shameful. How could a company support a book decrying the abuse of men and then turn around and give Allen a pile of money for his book? It might have stopped there, except for a rare and perhaps unprecedented move. Some 75 of Hachette's employees staged a public walkout to express their displeasure.
That never happens. Unbelievable. Yeah,
the company had, well, it happened at Google, so.
No, I mean in the publishing world.
Oh, okay. The company had second thoughts and canceled the book, returning all the rights to Allen. You know, apropos of nothing, not a word was said about whether Hachette would demand its advance back. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. A publishing company decides
a big
not,
what? A big whoop.
Company decides not to publish a book. That happens. It was remarkable why it happened. And, you know, companies think, you know, hey, you should be able to publish books by conservatives and liberals. People on this side of an issue and people on that side of an issue. Fair enough, but when you're talking about molesting children, are there two sides to the issue? Either you believe that you published this serious work of nonfiction called Catch and Kill, you were right about that, by Ronan Farrow and others, talking about how they broke the Me Too era story and helped to try and bring these people to justice. You know, there isn't another side to that story. And Woody Allen's memoir had gone begging for quite a few years now. Publishing houses just didn't want to touch it after his fall from grace. He was not found guilty in a court of law, just in the court of public opinion. And you can say, hey, somebody should
publish
that.
Well, I don't think, was he ever even brought, indicted?
He was certainly, the courts were involved and it wasn't investigated and looked into. There were official investigations and no charges were brought.
Right.
But it wasn't like people just talk about it. It was looked into. And of course, you have a quote from one of the judges saying that his behavior was grossly inappropriate towards his child. So it's not like people said, oh, nothing there, nothing to see here. So, you know, we have to decide for yourselves whether you want to watch his movies or deal with him. He's still a person. Whether you want to make a movie with him or publish a book by him, that's your own corporation's decision. Stephen King said, I'm scared of this. Maybe you don't like Woody Allen, but we shouldn't, you know, stifle free speech. Well, we're not. Another publishing house is free to do so. But Hachette said, you know what? We just published a book about this specifically and written by a child, you know, in his circle, Ronan Farrow. And we proudly touted that book and made the money off of it. And our employees have said, you know what? Having done that, we don't feel it's right to publish this other book. That seems hypocritical to us. And we take those charges seriously. We don't want to be involved with that. And they said, you know, we've had second thoughts. It does matter what our different divisions do. And we're going to pull back on that one. Someone else wants to publish it, great. Woody Allen can self-publish it. I actually would probably read it to see if there was interesting stuff about his movies. He still has great films. But I think their decision was appropriate because they were listening to their employees. It's not stifling free speech. It's saying, let's not be hypocrites.
Well, yeah, I think what Stephen King was pointing out is that, you know, look, systems are in place. You know, the guy wasn't charged with
anything. That's why he's not in jail. We're not talking about putting him in jail. We're talking about deciding whether you want to work with him. And give him a lot of money.
Right. He then, by the way, Stephen King went on to say, by the way, it was really tone deaf for Hachette to try and publish this book.
Right after doing the other one. Yeah, exactly. I mean, again, he hasn't been found guilty in a court of law. There were no charges brought. We do know that for many years, people avoided justice for lots of complicated reasons, not least of which it's really hard to prove rape and child molestation. It ain't easy for lots of complicated reasons. Whether he is innocent or guilty, I don't know. I'd be happy to read the book, but I can understand Hachette not wanting to publish it.
Well, maybe Simon & Schuster will publish it. In fact, Viacom CBS woke up this morning and said, books? Who cares about books? And so Simon & Schuster is up for sale. Their explanation? Well, you know, when they took a close look at the books, they said, these aren't video-based. There's no video here. You can't look at a book. Well, okay, you can look at a book, but it's not like there's pictures. Well, okay, there might be pictures in like nonfiction and kids' books, but it's mostly just text. And what does that have to do with video? CBS is a network with video. CBS All Access? Yeah, video. Paramount? Movies are visual too. Cable channels like BET and MTV, local TV stations, their stake in the CW all makes sense to the company, which just posted a quarterly loss after the remerger of CBS and Viacom. So Simon & Schuster is the odd man out, along with CBS headquarters BlackRock in Manhattan, which they're also selling. That's being sold too. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's one of the big imprints in North America and just has a big impact on culture and what books get made and get seen by people. Simon & Schuster is one of my favorite imprints, if it's not weird to say that about such a big publishing house. And I thought for a second, this is so bizarre. Why do they not think this is part of their media empire? Well, they don't have a media empire anymore. They sold off CBS Radio. They sold off their music label. They're selling Television City in the heart of Los Angeles. You know what? They had a good media empire in which books made sense. Radio, movies, music. Television, books. That to me was a great company. I don't think they should have sold any of those off, but now that they have, I guess, whatever, they're selling off one more. It feels like they're cutting off their limbs one by one. It may make sense now, but that's just because they've already done so much damage to the great company that they once were.
So what's football legend Tom Brady going to do? Well, even this year, I mean, will he sign with the Patriots?
He's going to Disney World. Well, not so much because there's big crowds there.
Right. Well, the question that a lot of people have wondered not only is where will he sign this year? Because he is a free agent. Will he stick with the Patriots that he's been with for 20 years? Or what's he going to do after his career ends? Well, apparently he's going to Hollywood, as Michael, you just mentioned. Brady formed a production company, and he is partnering with the Russo brothers to launch a project about this sport called football, actually. He's got other projects, not all of them sports-related, and proving this wasn't really a sudden decision, but one he planned for a while, whether he'll score a touchdown or be called off sides for meddling movies is still to be determined. Tell me, Michael, is this a big deal or is it, pass interference?
I'm being possessed by the spirit of Karen Woodward. Man forms production company. Big whoop. Not only is it not a big whoop, I don't care. And, you know, he made sports. He thinks he can make movies and TV shows. Knock yourself out. If they're not football related, I wonder what it will be.
I think a lot of people look at this and go, well, you know, this is the exact same reason why LeBron James went to the Lakers, because he wants to be closer to Hollywood, where his career will kind of proceed after basketball. Well, maybe, you know, the Chargers are looking for a quarterback, FYI. So anyway, the Professional Golfers Association, an association that I am proud to be a member of.
Are you the PGA?
Yeah.
What's your handicap?
I can't play golf, actually.
You mean you don't have the time or you suck at it?
Both. In fact, both. They just signed
your weakness really is your short game, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and my long game. And everything having
and
to do with
the middle game.
Yeah. Anything that you put in that club bag thingy that people carry around.
I'm good at the 19th hole. That's about it. Actually, I'm not even good there. I can drive the cart.
I do really well at the one with the windmill, getting it through the little things. But then my ball never
comes
back.
You do play golf.
Yeah.
Do you watch golf on TV? Because frankly, golf is a lot more exciting to watch than it ever was before. They do such a great job with golf now that it is a strong TV ratings, even without Tiger Woods. And so I'm not surprised that their TV rights are going for more money than ever.
I'm really surprised that golf, like reruns of golf on YouTube, haven't like picked up because of ASMR.
Yeah,
like,
you're right.
All of the
he's moving towards the green. He's gonna. Oh, there's a bird on the field. Oh, he's.
Could you? And then the whoosh of the club.
Thrill up and down your spine. So tell us about this story.
Well, the PGA just signed a big new TV deal. No surprise. Streaming is part of the package, probably for ASMR, by the way. The major networks, CBS and NBC, remain the main home for big events. CBS covers 19 big tournament weekends, while NBC covers 8. When are these on? I've never
all
seen them.
All the time.
Well, early round coverage appears on NBC's Golf Channel, and they rotate covering the big three playoff events, with the networks taking a turn every other year. No surprise there. Here are the new wrinkles. First, ESPN Plus will become the home for tons of online content and tournaments for those who don't have terrestrial TV. And the PGA will be providing feeds and technical support at every tournament. NBC and CBS will stick with their broadcasters, but the PGA will be almost literally calling the shots, giving them a mountain of footage they own and control and can use to promote the game worldwide, feed to their own online sites, you know, feed to YouTube for ASMR reasons, and more. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. This is sort of the blueprint for a sports rights deal. You want to have multiple people involved. You want them all competing with each other for a piece of your pie, and you want them all be paying a lot of money. They now have the big three networks, CBS, NBC, and ABC are all shoveling in tons of money to the PGA. That's exactly what you want. They've got networks. They've got a cable channel. They have a streaming service now on ESPN Plus. They have their, and most interestingly of all, I think, is them holding the rights and controlling all the footage. They are now doing everything in the back room. Like, they're laying the cable. They're setting up the cameras. They're doing all the feeds, and they're using all that footage to sort of build up a library of stuff that they can use for their own apps and cable channel or whatever else they may do down the road, you know, all the stuff that they want to do and make available to the world. So I think this is exactly the sort of deal every sports group is looking to make.
An appellate court overturned a lower court and says a retrial is not necessary for the fight over whether the band
Led Zeppelin,
yeah, whether they ripped off Stairway to Heaven from an instrument written by another
instrumental.
Written by another band that they toured with. It's a complicated ruling, but establishes enough new ground that it may be presented to the Supreme Court. And one area is of particular note. This ruling rejects the inverse ratio rule, which argues the more access to a work that someone has, the lower the standard to prove they plagiarized. In other words, because Led Zeppelin toured with another band and the song they allegedly ripped off was played on stage repeatedly, the inverse ratio rule lowers the bar for proving they stole from it. In other words, it's easier to prove someone ripped off, say, Casablanca, than a student film that no one has ever watched.
In other words, if your movie is really popular, it should be easier for you to prove someone ripped it off than if it's just obscure. And that's where the court said, nah. That not so much. Just because you're popular doesn't mean you don't have to provide the overwhelming evidence or preponderance of evidence to prove that someone, you know, knowingly plagiarized your work. So I think this is a big deal. I don't know what it means to say that it may be presented to the Supreme Court. That was wording taken from one of the news stories. I took it to imply that the case may get appealed to the Supreme Court. They were talking quite at length about how this may set new standards for copyright law. I didn't feel equipped to go up for it yet. We should have had our in-house lawyer on the show to discuss this. Maybe we'll have them on in the week or two.
Yeah, you know, here's the thing. If you listen to both, and this has been kind of discussed.
Meaning the song Taurus and the song Stairway to Heaven.
Right. They are both in A minor with a descending bass chord. That's very true of many songs. They both have the first three kind of, you know, chord licks the same, and then Stairway to Heaven kind of goes off. But it's very interesting. If you look up on YouTube, they, you know, people comparing them by playing them on guitar just to show the difference between the two and the similarities. It's fascinating.
Cool.
But, you know, try describing that to a jury. I don't know how you would do that.
It ain't easy.
Well, right. And neither is, you know, music in general, which is the subject of our Inside Baseball segment this week. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, we are talking about music, as I just said, because the major music labels are generating $1 million an hour from streaming, and it's going directly to the artists. We all know that.
I have to say, we have to give credit to Music Business Worldwide. I'm finding a lot of great analysis and stories I'm not seeing covered in depth or at all in other locations. So they're doing Billboard one better, and they're doing a great job. And in fact, the U.S. recorded music business hit $11 billion in 2019. How much of that comes from streaming? 80%. 80% of their total revenue from recorded music. This doesn't include touring and other things, but 80% of that recorded music business is coming from streaming. That includes ads placed on artist music videos on YouTube, to freemium levels where people watch an ad before they watch a song, right up to the $10 a month you pay for Spotify or Apple Music. So,
Can I just mention just anecdotally here?
Please.
I was sitting in a coffee shop recently, and they were talking about this. The people sitting next to me, there were like four people sitting next to me, they were all on the same Spotify account. But then they discovered they were all on somebody else's Spotify account, and each one of them knew three other people on that Spotify account. So they wanted to know the person who they're all giving $3 to per month, who owns this Spotify account. Like, how much are they making? Because they're probably making a good, like, $30 a month based on the fact that 10 people have that. And I just thought, it's $10 a month. You can't afford $10. You're in a coffee shop, for Pete's sake, where coffee costs $5 a cup. Pay the $10
a
month.
Sounds like an anecdote that's not true. That's an urban myth. But I guess since you're saying you're saying random people somehow discovered.
No. They were all friends. They were all friends.
And they're all paying somebody else $3 to get access to their streaming service?
They were all paying one of their friends who wasn't present $3 a month.
Why the hell would they do that? Why wouldn't they just get it for free from somebody else?
I have no idea.
That's bizarre. Who cares? And the companies, you know, they need to figure out you can only have it on so many devices. And then after that, you got to pay more. That's a reasonable. I don't think they need to spend all their time and energy making sure if you've got a family plan and there are four people on it, making sure that their actual family are in the same city. Don't deal with that. Don't worry about that. Don't care about it. If they've got five people, charge them more. But there are four people, four devices all over the world. Who cares? Just, you know, stick to focusing on what you can do easily and simply, and not trying to, you know, decide what constitutes a family or a friend or a lover or, you know, a child, an adult. Don't worry about all that. If somebody's
internationally, they're right.
But if somebody's got 20 devices, well, yeah, you understand what I'm saying. If somebody's got 20 devices hooked up to their Spotify account, that should be very easy to determine and turn off. You know, say, no, you can't have 20. You can only have four. Then the fifth one just doesn't work. I don't understand how that could even happen. You know, because
I agree with you.
Technically, I don't understand how it happened. They must have strictures in place. I don't understand how you could have
that. That would have thought.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. Anyway, the rate of growth for streaming revenue, which is 80% of the total revenue for recorded music, the rate of growth in North America is slowing dramatically. It's gone from, in the last 3 or 4 years, from 70% in 2016 to 40% to 30%. To now 20% in 2019. So,
do you know what we call that? Do you know what we call that in business?
A mature market?
Oh, darn it. You took my punchline.
Oh, okay. So I think looking at 2020, maybe we can expect a 10% growth. So maybe we'll go from $11 billion to, it's only 80% of the revenue. So assuming other things also grow at 10%, maybe we'll hit $12 billion or a little bit over that. So that would be a reasonable expectation. And vinyl, by the way, is $500 million in 2019. $500 million was spent on vinyl in North America in 2019. And that's growing. The rate of growth and the revenue are both accelerating. They're passing digital sales. More money spent on vinyl than digital. In fact, this year, 2020, they will probably beat compact discs in North America for total revenue for the first time since 1986. That's kind of amazing. But what country will they not be doing that in?
Japan, probably, because Japan, I know that Japan and maybe is it Korea as well? I don't know. They still sell a lot of compact discs in Japan.
That's right. They love to have their physical product, which is interesting since I think of Japan as being the country of the Walkman and the Discman, which revolutionized music and made it so portable. But they're not as excited by the digital. They want the quality, perhaps the audio quality, or maybe they're just proud that Japan innovated with the compact disc via Sony. I'm not quite sure what the cultural or technical reasons are why they have not subscribed to subscription as heavily as other countries, but it's still dominant. You know, recorded music is the biggest source there, but subscription is catching up. Spotify generated, in total, I'm seeing all streaming services generated $385 million last year, and that grew by 33%, so probably about $100, $130 million in growth that year. So they are the world's second biggest recorded music market. The United States is number one, Japan is number two, and Germany looks like they're about to pass the United Kingdom to become the world's third biggest market for music, which makes me ask the question, not India? I guess maybe they're talking about total revenue.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Now, speaking of India, you mentioned India. Mm-hmm. Do you want to say why you mentioned India?
Please go. Keep going.
Well, you know, Spotify is in India, and they're you know, priced at a certain level that's conducive to being
right. They reflect the local market and the local incomes. They're right. It's lower than it is in the U.S. Of course. Keep going.
But now, ByteDance, the parent company of TikTok, I would like to find whoever invented TikTok and just wrap my hands like every parent hates TikTok. All their kids are like, huh, what were you talking to me? It's like, get off TikTok. I'm talking to you.
Tell me what's
take
happening.
Out the trash.
Tell us what's happening.
Okay, well, that company is moving into India with their own streaming service.
That's right. Resso is owned by ByteDance, so they will be competing against Spotify, Apple Music, and local players like Gaana and JioSaavn. So Resso has joined in. That's from the company who's behind the social media juggernaut TikTok. And that's important because one of the big draws of Resso, like, how are you going to distinguish yourself? Everybody has the same music, right? They all
except Resso doesn't have universal
we're not
music.
There. We're not there yet. Oh, okay. In general, companies all over the world are offering the same bundle of music. Apple Music and Amazon Music and Spotify, they're basically offering the same stuff. They might have an exclusive for a week or two, but basically you go on there, you're seeing the same music you see everywhere else. How can you stand out? The way Resso does it is with their social media savvy. Their app allows you to easily share snippets of songs or even entire tracks across multiple platforms, like presumably Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and so on. You can also talk about how much you love BTS and Billie Eilish right there on the app. They have social media communities right there built into the app. And of course, they help that flexibility helps them to stand out. But like you said, they are missing one big catalog, Universal Music. What's going on there?
Well, the company hasn't re-upped with Spotify yet either, I should point out.
Right, so those contract negotiations are still going on. I don't think it hasn't lapsed yet. It's not that Universal Music isn't available on Spotify, but the contract is looming, and it could be off there soon. What's going on?
I have a feeling that they're going to try and launch their own streaming service, aren't they?
Could this be the end of every music streaming app offering the same basic catalog? Now,
that would just suck, to be honest with you.
Absolutely. Well, that's what people...
Pardon my French, but it would be horrible.
But that's exactly what people demanded in television. They said what they really wanted was a low monthly fee for their cable service, but since they couldn't get it, they said, fine, just give me HBO. Just give me Turner Classic Movies or ESPN. That's all I want. And then they realize, oh, I also want CBS and Fox and PBS and maybe CNN. And I like the Food Network. So now they're paying individually for Netflix and Hulu and CBS All Access and all these other channels that are popping up. And they're going to find their bill gets really big. So I can see a demand perhaps for like a specialized streaming service, like maybe classical music or jazz or Broadway. Those are poorly served by the streaming services that are out there right now. So somebody who could offer like everything in a killer app with great sound quality, maybe there's an audience for that. And that niche service like BritBox or something like that, that would make sense. But if we're going to have to pay for, I guess there's just three, right? Sony, Universal, and Warner Music. Is it Warner Music?
Yes.
Yeah. If we have to pay for those three individually, it'd still be just a big pain in the neck not to have them all in the same service.
Not only that, but like then like here's my playlist of only Universal Music. That makes no sense.
Right.
At all.
Well, you'd want something like Apple TV. They have a great service where you have all your apps available in that one area and you can easily find whatever show you're looking for. You're going to need somebody to do that, you know, bring them back all together again into the same, you know, same platform. It's called Spotify, I guess, or Apple Music or Amazon, but that may be ended. Oof, that'll be a nightmare. Yeah.
Well, I know one thing that, you know, it would be kind of interesting if Blue Note did a, like, their own streaming service and then said, look, yes, we have everything that you can get on Spotify of, say, McCoy Tyner, who we're going to be talking about in a moment. But we also have some, like, you know, box set type stuff that you can't get on Spotify because, frankly, on Spotify, it would be played once a year by one person. So, you know, we're going to have it here. And if you want to sign up for that and get, like, some academic encyclopedic stuff, yeah.
Well, you're right. There's some great stuff on Blue Note from McCoy Tyner, especially in his key mid-60s period where he did The Real McCoy and Tender Moments. But there's a lot of stuff on Impulse, a lot of stuff on Milestone. He's got some Columbia. You know, he's got music all over the place. Birdology. So he's even got his own music released on his own label, McCoy Tyner Music. So, you know, when you want to listen to McCoy Tyner, you don't want to go to the Blue Note app. You want to have access to all of it in the same spot. But right now, you're going to want to listen to The Real McCoy or some classic John Coltrane because McCoy Tyner has just died at the age of 81, one of the great jazz pianists, a mainstay of John Coltrane's recorded work with his classic quartet. He had that period where some of his most important albums like A Love Supreme, Crescent, My Favorite Things, when those albums were being recorded, McCoy Tyner was right there in that quartet. So he's a hugely influential and important pianist. He recorded with Wayne Shorter, Joe Henderson, Freddie Hubbard, his own great stuff. But, you know, John Coltrane looms large. You know, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Louis Armstrong, there aren't that many jazz artists as big as Coltrane. And McCoy Tyner was a key part of that. And I've been spending the week listening to The Real McCoy and Enlightenment, and you should too.
Well, now, I see that you've also highlighted somebody else here named Mart Crowley. Why don't you tell us who that is? He passed away at the age of 84.
Well, he's a playwright, and he has one big credit to his name. He was an assistant to actress Natalie Wood. I think he might have even been on the boat when she died in those mysterious circumstances all those years ago. But she encouraged him to keep writing. He was a writer, and he was making a living by being her assistant, and he was openly gay and writing, working for her. And she said, keep writing, keep writing. And the result is a campy, caustic, groundbreaking play called The Boys in the Band, which played off Broadway and ran and ran and ran. It got turned into a feature film, which was both loved and hated by gay people because it's filled with self-loathing, bitchy characters, always ready with a quip or a cry. And it felt like he was telling tales out of school. Gay people may talk to themselves this way or show themselves or act like this is part of their life, but we don't want other people to see it because it's sort of ugly at times. So the play's sort of dated, and then no, it's not dated. People embrace it again. I've never really cared for it, but it's a landmark work of theater, no doubt about that. And he broke down barriers, whatever you think of the play as a work of art. And to show how far we've come, on the 50th anniversary of the play, it first debuted in 1968. On the 50th anniversary in 2018, the play played on Broadway and got Tony nominations. It featured an all-star cast of people you would know, and every single one of them was openly gay. That's kind of amazing.
Well, speaking of kind of amazing, that kind of describes the career of Max von Sydow, an actor who starred in, like, what? He was an actor for over 60 years. Everything from The Seventh Seal all the way up through Game of Thrones.
That's right. He died at the age of 90, and of course, best known for his lifelong collaboration with director Ingmar Bergman. They made 11 films together, which puts them in the august company of like John Ford and John Wayne or Scorsese and De Niro. Just a hugely successful actor in his native tongue and English. I don't think we recognize...
By native tongue, you mean Swedish.
Right.
We didn't say that.
Well, yeah. We said he was Swedish.
You did? Okay, my fault.
Didn't we? I think we did. Maybe we didn't. He was nominated twice for the Oscar. He's the only Swedish man ever to be so honored. But I don't think we recognize enough how challenging it must be to be a great actor in French and English or German and Russian. You know, that's really quite an accomplishment. You know, it's not the silent era. So I think we should tip our hat to people like him and, you know, Antonio Banderas and whomever you love who does great acting in both languages. That's really quite a hurdle to be overcome. I was a little surprised he never got an honorary Oscar, I guess. It doesn't look like it as far as I could tell. I find that a little surprising.
Yeah, no, he was nominated twice, never received an Oscar. Yeah. It's kind of like hard to believe, really.
Yeah, I mean, that really, in recent years, the last 5-10 years, they should have said, hey, how about that Max von Sydow guy? He did great films, obviously. Wild Strawberries, The Best Intentions, Pele the Conqueror. I think that was one of his Oscar nominations. The two-part movie, not thought of much anymore, but The Emigrants and the New Land, that's a great couple of movies. He also did things like Star Wars, The Force Awakens, and Strange Brew with the movie from the guys from SCTV. Hannah and Her Sisters, 3 Days of the Condor. His English language breakthrough was playing Jesus in The Greatest Story Ever Told, one of those lumbering bioepics. It was all about the Bible, and in it, he played Jesus. And it was, he said, one of the most challenging things he ever did because he had to be Jesus. It was challenging. And it always reminds me of his role in Hannah and Her Sisters, where he played an artist. And at one moment in the movie, apropos of nothing, I don't know what happened. I think people were trying to buy one of his pieces of art, and they said, hey, you got anything in brown? We need something whiter that can match our couch. You know, and he was about to just strangle them to death. And he was just enraged by something on the news. And he said, if Jesus Christ came back today and saw what people were doing in his name, they never stop throwing up. And the fact that he said that and played Jesus, I thought was funny. And here's a telling thing. When you look at the headlines for his death, you always saw the seventh seal, which, by the way, is funny. The seventh seal is remembered as this grim movie, and it's certainly serious, but there's a lot of humor in it, which I didn't realize till I saw it at Film Forum with a paying audience. There's a lot of fun humor in that movie. Wild Strawberries is delightful as well. But when you saw his name, Max von Sydow died, they all said, star of The Seventh Seal and depending on the outlet, it was something else. One person said The Exorcist. Another person said Star Wars. Another one said Game of Thrones. And then somebody said Flash Gordon. Yes, he did star in Flash Gordon.
Have to go back and actually watch that to go, where was he?
He's a big player in the movie, but it's such an awful film. It's funny to pick that up. But he made a lot of bad movies. You know, he came to Hollywood. He made some great films, made a lot of junk, but he made money too. So good for him.
Well, speaking of making money, please feel free to donate to us.
Can they?
I shouldn't have said that.
You certainly shouldn't have. Are we having a show next week? I forgot to ask.
Yes, we are. You can subscribe to us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, or Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can rate and review our show, subscribe to us. It does help us out when you do. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. You can also find ways to email us there, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmd.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's Ming the Merciless. What do you mean you don't know what character he played? He played the villain, Ming the Merciless, Max von Sydow did in Flash Gordon. How could you forget Ming the Merciless? That's one of his better silly roles. It's a silly movie, that's for sure.
Oh, and that's a dot com. I was going to say that's a dot org.
Yeah. No, that's a dot com. That's a dot com.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.